Okay, Rabbi, we'll do a very quick introduction. If I may, it's welcome back, Rabbi Anstandig, who was, as you heard, grew up in West Bloomfield, Michigan, and actually worked for a number of years in Ann Arbor. I don't exactly know how far apart they are from each other, but working in the Hillel in Ann Arbor, which is where he was from before he came here to Toronto to be the assistant Rosh Beit Midrash in the Beit Midrash Zichron Dov, where he still teaches. And he is currently serving as the rabbi, one of the rabbis at Sher Shemaim Congregation in Toronto. It's a graduate of Yeshiva University, the master's in history from Bernard Revel. And I had to talk to you about something, a chaplain in the U.S. Reserve Army. So you can talk about that some other time. But
I can bring it up. I can bring it up tonight. I can make it fit.
Okay. And Parshat Vayikra, which I think we will all agree is the most exciting of the five books of the Chumash. I think there's no disagreement about that, right? We're into Purim Torah a little bit early. So, okay, Rabbi Vakashat, it's all yours.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Kelman. It's always a pleasure to share Torah. Thank you for inviting me on to share some Torah. Thank you, everyone, for coming and joining to learn a little bit of Torah. That's not the right link here. I'll put a link in the chat box here. I'm 99% sure that this link should work. I'm just checking it on my computer, and yes, it is working. Okay, so that should be good. If you follow that link, it should take you to a Google Doc. I don't know. I apologize. I didn't get the email to Casey early enough, but Rabbi Kelman, if you're able to, if Casey's here, can find a way to
email it to me. If you email it to me, I'll try to post it while you're talking. Can I copy it? I don't know how this teeny CC. I don't know from those things. But,
here, so I'm sharing it to you with you right now.
Okay.
You should receive it now. Good. Okay. Let me just see what happened with that. I don't know, but it's okay. I don't think the dot. Yeah. Okay. Very good. Okay. So all right. So I made the mistake this time. I actually made the same mistake this time that I did the last time I gave a Torah in Motion Shir, but Baruch Hashem, I think it went well. But I did it on Parshat Bamidbar, and I remember when I sat down to do it, I was like, "What was I thinking? Why did I choose Parshat Bamidbar?" Thank God, I think it was really interesting for me. It was interesting to research and to learn about, and I had fun learning it. So I guess that's what I was thinking about when I sat down, and I'm like, wait, why did I choose Vayikra? Like, what am I doing? You know, and I think, for a lot of people, I think when people have, Jews have serious Torah learning, most of them, the highest level that a lot of Jews get to, as far as if they're doing intense learning of Chumash, ends up being in high school. What I think, sometimes you'll go and later on go to yeshiva or seminary, but even so, it's not necessarily going to be focused so much on Chumash. But I think a lot of times most people, max they do is in high school. And high school, of course, is 4 years, which is great. Bereshit, Shmot, Bamidbar, Devarim, and you never actually learn Vayikra. And, I thought about Vayikra, like, what am I going to talk about Vayikra? What is there to talk about Vayikra? I don't know anything about Korbanot, anything about Vayikra. It's like so not relevant to my life. But in the course of, as I was reading the Parsha, looking at various different commentaries on it, I think there's actually a lot of, number one, beauty to the Parsha, beauty to the structure of what's going on. And I think something interesting, just simply intellectually, I think could be interesting to understand. The Torah is giving us a whole series of mitzvot. We have a whole sefer. Torat Kohanim is a whole sefer of Korbanot, of learning about these things. It's there for a reason. I mean, there's something we can learn and gain from it. And so I think I'm excited that I chose this Parsha, and I hope you'll hopefully be excited by the time we're through with this. You'll also see there's something of value in Parshat Vayikra, Sefer Vayikra, Parshat Vayikra in particular. And that's what I'm hoping to do with you tonight. So because this was on Zoom, I took the liberty. Normally I try to be like page conscious and not, spread out in as many pages. So this though is actually, I think it comes 7 pages, but it's longer than it looks. I mean, no, it's not as long as it looks. It's shorter than it looks. It's just because I had the flexibility so I could keep things on the same page together. So I didn't have to worry about, double side this, that. So it spreads out. If you're going to print it out, you can, try to cut off the white space. But if you could also just look at it on your computer screen, that'll also, you'll be just as good. But don't get intimidated by the length, because it's not as long. I don't think it's as long as it looks. But anyway, so we can start here. with Parshat Vayikra, as I mentioned before, it doesn't feel very relevant. There's not much I think I read it and I'm like, okay, be honest, until I was doing this and really sketched it out, like I you tell me Sefer Parshat Vayikra is just like a random assortment. It's a random assortment to of just different korbanot. Like, it didn't really mean anything. But hopefully right now we'll see that there's actually some structure. And what I do is I want us to explore the differences that appear in the structure and the layout between the beginning of in the beginning of our Sefer, starting with Parshat Vayikra, and comparing that to the beginning of Parshat Tzav, which is next week's Parsha. For anyone, by the way, if you want to download the, if you have this Google Doc and the file in the on the top left corner, there's file and download. There's a way to download it as a PDF. Otherwise, I can download it, and I'll email this to Rabbi Kelman either way, so it'll go out if you don't have the source sheets. But you should be able to get it on the in the source that I on the link tiny.cc/source sheet, all lowercase. You should be able to pick it up from there. Okay, so I want to start now with source number one. So instead of giving like just blocks and blocks of text, what I gave for you is a summary basically of Parshat Vayikra, Parshat Tzav. Not my own summary. My brother-in-law, several 10 years ago, 15 years ago maybe, he bought me this beautiful little handheld chumash, put it in my backpack, keep it in my talis bag. And it has these amazing little, like, at every beginning of every chapter, it gives like a brief summary of what happens in that chapter. So instead of me summarizing it for myself, I'm just relying on what this chumash did. I just reproduced it. I just copied and not copy and pasted. I just typed it up from what is here. So if you don't agree with the summary, it's not mine. It's the chumash called Nechbad Lemar'eh. It's their layout. But so here's just a summary, and I tried to color coordinate this as well. The first Perek Aleph, chapter one, it's as you can see, the highlighted in the red lettering, it's all about the Olah sacrifice. Korban, it's a sacrifice that's brought voluntarily and fully consumed. Sources, you know, commandment to bring it, and then it talks about the Olah sacrifice of an ox, Olah, how that's performed, of bakar, and then it's of tzon, sheep, and then it's of oaf, of birds. And it sort of lays out the first perek. It just lays out here. You're going to bring an Olah. You have three different genres, so to speak. It could be like A, B, or C. That's how it plays out. And then it moves to chapter two, Perek Bet, and you have the English on the left, the Hebrew on the right. You have the mincha, this meal offering. And again, it lays it out again, a meal of offering of flour, meal offering from the oven, of the griddle, of a pan, generals, and meal offerings of first fruits. Again, this perek focusing entirely on the mincha, on menachot, on these flower ones. Okay, I can share the screen. That maybe we do that. That's fine. If I can remember how to do that. To do. Here we are. Okay. Okay, here we are. So people can hopefully see here. Okay. So fine. So we have the meal offerings, the Korban Mincha, and then moves to chapter three. It's the Shlamim, another type of offering. And again, it lives the same basic pattern. And this is the green, chapter number three, the Shlamim of the sheep, Shlamim of the lamb, of the goat. And then there's this another non-Shlamim related prohibition against eating fats of chelev and dam. And then moves on to chapter number four, about the chatat for sin offerings. And now we're talking about things that are totally, they're not voluntary anymore. Now this is the category of obligatory korbanot. Chatat offering, which is, you know, verses one and two of chapter four, rules of the chatat offering of the anointed Kohen who sins, and then the offering of a cow that when the community sins unwittingly, par ha'elem davar, which is also, chatat is when someone is unintentionally, unknowingly, unwittingly violating a sin. So again, still within the same category, community sins unwittingly. Chatat offering of the nasi, of the leader. Rules of a regular chatat offering when, you know, Joe Schmo sins, how he or she brings their korban chatat. The rules of the regular chatat offering that's brought from a lamb versus a goat, those are that. And then moving into chapter five, which is the last perek that we focus on, is this the first half is this a light blue korban oleh ve'yored. I call this, the translation is all mine. The Hebrew is this chumash. It was my own translation. I called it the sliding scale offering. If you do a certain, a particular sin, and so the actual offering that you give is going to vary depending on how much money you have. So it's a sliding scale. It's oleh or yored. The cost of it goes up or goes down depending on how much money you have. So it introduces that concept, and then it's offering of the wealthy, offering of the impoverished, and how it's performed, and the offering of this extremely destitute, and how it's performed. And that's this korban oleh ve'yored, a sin offering for specific sins. And then it continues to the guilt offering, the korban asham, guilt offering for religious trespass, rules of guilt offering for doubtful guilt. You're not sure that I do it wrong, did it or not. Rules of the guilt offering for theft, and if I steal something. And that's basically the Parsha. So now we can move on to Musaf. We're done. We're done for Shabbos morning. But that was a Purim joke. We're still gonna have to read Torah on Shabbos morning. But you have here the basic layout starts with the Korban Olah, the sacrifice, then goes to Korban Mincha in the blue, then the green, the Shlamim, then this orangey Chatat, Korban Olah ve'Yored in the light blue, and then the pink, the Asham, the guilt offering in the pink. And it lays out like that, beautiful. And if we were to, if the We were to move on to the next parsha, we'd be good. We've got a lot of good material here. What's curious, and this is what I want to focus on tonight, what's curious is that the next parsha, Parsha Tzav, which you're going to really the following week, recaps a lot of this. For instance, it starts in Perek 6, in Perek Vav. It starts with the rules of the korban. Again, this is the summary as laid out from this Chumash. Again, verses 1 through 6. All about the Ola offering. And then 7 through 11, the meal offering. And then a little bit more of the meal offering of the Kohen Gadol. And then the laws of the Korban Chatat. And then chapter 7, again, you have the guilt offering, the Asham, what Kohanim receive from the various offerings. And then the rules of the Thanksgiving of the Shlamim offering. And what you, the color coordinated in a way that if you go to the top of the third page, right, you see that there's a lot of overlap. You have the Ola mentioned in Vayikra, red. The Ola mentioned in Tzav, it's red. You have the Mincha in Vayikra, and you have the Mincha in Tzav. Now, the details of that Mincha are slightly different, and that's what we're gonna focus on. The fact that it says flour, oven, the griddle pan, and the first fruits in Parshat Vayikra, this week's Parsha. And next week's Parsha talks about personal, and talks about the Kohen specific, well, Korban that a Korban, the Mincha that a specifically Korban, Kohen gives. And then, back in Vayikra, you have Shlamim and Chatat and the Asham. But it's interesting in Tzav, and this is what we're going to focus on also, is that we have the same three again, Chatat, the Asham, and the Shlamim, the sin, the guilt, and the peace offering, the Shlamim offering. But you'll notice that the order is a little out of order. The Shlamim, which we had in Vayikra, was earlier. And in this one, in Tzav, next week's Parsha, it's at the end. One more piece to just put on this is that, and I put this in the little asterisk and the little caret. And then Sefer Vayikra, sorry, in Parshat Vayikra, the order seems to be fairly straightforward in that you start with these Ola, Mincha, and Shlamim, which were all given voluntarily. And then you have 4 and 5, the Chatat and the Asham, which are obligatory. I messed up. Now I bring this Korban. And because the Shlamim is out of order, it ends up being a little bit messier when it comes to Parshat Tzav, where it starts with the Ola and Mincha, so far so good. And then you jump to obligatory ones, like Chatat and the Asham, the sin offering, the guilt offering. And then, oh, by the way, we're going to go back to the voluntary ones with the light green, with the Shlamim, with number 5. What I want to focus on specifically is how do we account for this? Number one, why is it repeated? Number two, how do we deal with the differences, such as the Shlamim jumping from stage number 3, bounces down to number 5 in Parshat Tzav. And then some of the unique things about like this Kohen specific piece that's mentioned here in Parshat Tzav next week, but doesn't make an appearance at all in this week's Parsha. And when we can see that, we can understand what's going on here. I think we can have a deeper appreciation for Sefer Vayikra, for Parshat Vayikra, what it's happening. And I think even in general about the value of Sefer Vayikra in general. So far, so good. What I'm laying out for you is we have the version of the list of korbanot as we have in Sefer Vayikra, Parshat Vayikra, I'm sorry, Parshat Vayikra, and we are comparing it to what's going to happen the next week, in Parshat Tzav, and noting that number one, it's a repetition, and it's not even a great repetition because there's new information in one, and there's also something's different order in Tzav. Question is, what's going on? Why the repetition? Why the additional information? And why in the different order? I'm not the first person, certainly not the first person to observe this. This has been observed by many, many Mefarshim commentaries, great, great scholars. But I did read an article written by this Rabbi Yonatan Grossman, who's a rabbi in the Gush in Yeshivat Har Etzion, rabbi doctor, I believe. And he's an expert in Tanakh and really in literary analysis and really exploring the text in different language differences here and there. So this is based primarily on a piece that he had written, which I thought was, I really enjoyed reading it because it really made Sefer Vayikra make a lot more sense to me. And so that's, I'm going to present to you essentially what, his suggestions, Rabbi Yonatan Grossman. So the first thing that is worth noting is we saw the summary up above in sources one and two and the comparison. But Rabbi Dr. Grossman goes into specifics. Like, well, let's look at some of the details, comparing actually the presentation between, say, Parshat Vayikra and Parshat Tzav. And let's actually note what some of the differences are and actually get into it. And when we can see how the presentation differs, we can actually get to a better appreciation for what's going on. So we'll start with source number four, or continue now with source number four, which has two parts. The top part is from Parshat Vayikra, and the second part from Parshat Tzav. And I tried to bold to focus, emphasize the things that I want to focus on. So we start in Vayikra, the top section of source number four. So this is talking about the Ola offering, and it mentions it's innards and its legs. He shall wash, the Kohen's going to wash this with water. The priest shall burn all of it on the altar for a burnt offering, an offering made by fire, a pleasant aroma to Hashem. Okay, that's the Ola offering. And then it continues when it talks about the Korban Mincha, the meal offering, in the second paragraph in the Vayikra section of page of source number four. It's giving these details. Okay, he brings it. He pours this oil on it. They bring it to the priest. Okay, he takes a handful of it. Cohen's going to take it. He's going to scoop part of it. He's going to offer some of it. And there's going to be a leftover, which is going to belong to Aaron and his sons. So, whereas the Ola offering was burnt up completely, you have the Mincha, some of it's not just burnt up completely, there is leftover, and the leftover is actually given to Aaron and his sons. They get to eat that. If you compare the presentation, what we just saw in Vayikra, of the Ola and the Mincha, it's actually noteworthy, even subtle, but significant differences or additions or... Yeah, when it's presented in Parshat Tzav. For instance, in the top paragraph now of the Tzav section, Vedaber Hashem Moshe Lemor, this is the very beginning of Parshat Tzav, when it's talking about the Korban Ola. Tzav et Aaron ve'banav Lemor, you know, command Aaron and his sons to say, Zot Torat HaOla, this is the rule of the Ola. Hi HaOla al Magdal Mizbeach, kol ha'layla ad boker, it's going to burn the whole night, put it on and let it burn through the night again, it's going to be totally consumed. You're going to have the fire burning there all the time. But now it's giving more. And talk. Now we're learning about the priest shall wear his linen clothing, linen breeches he shall wear on his flesh, and he shall take up the ashes to which the fire had reduced the burnt offering on the altar, and put them next to the altar. He shall take off his garments and wear other garments. He shall bring the ashes outside the camp to a pure place, and the fire on the altar shall be kept burning on it. It shall not be extinguished. The priest shall burn it wood. Every morning and arrange upon it the burnt offering and burnt upon it and the fat of the peace offerings or perpetual fire to be kept burning on the altar. It shall not be extinguished. It's covering the same information, but it's giving us a lot. Number one, it's telling, okay, so it burns the whole day. Okay, shkoach. But that's telling us, and the Kohen, he wears a special uniform. He collects the ashes. He takes them out. He puts them in the outside. Yeah, what to do with it? They make sure the fire is always burning. It's mentioning the Korban Ola here, but so much more of this is focusing on the Kohen, what the Kohen's supposed to do, the uniform the Kohen wears. And again, if we were to move to the second when it talks about the Korban Mincha. V'zot Torata Mincha, this is the law of the Korban Mincha. Hakrevotah b'nei Aaron lifnei Hashem el p'nei hamizbeach ve'rim imenu b'kumso misolat hamincha u'mishamna v'kol avona asher hamincha v'ktir mizbeach reich tichach azkaratel Hashem. This is the law of the meal offering. The sons of Aaron shall offer it before Hashem, before the altar. He shall take from there his handful of the fine flour of the meal offering and of its oil and all the frankincense which is on the meal offering and shall burn it on the altar for a pleasant aroma as its memorial to Hashem. Okay? Great. And then it continues, "Vanoter mimena yochlu Aharon uvanav matzot teyachal v'makom kadosh v'chatzar o amoed yochluha." That which is left of it, Aharon and his son shall eat. We know that. We saw that already earlier. It said that the leftovers, "Vanoter mina mincha l'Aharon uvanav." But it tells us a lot more here too. It gives us more details of how it's eaten. "Vanoter mimena yochlu Aharon uvanav matzot teyachal v'makom kadosh v'chatzar o amoed yochluha." Before what we had in Parshat Vayikra, okay. Whatever's left over is eaten there. Kodesh Kodashim. Okay, it's the most Kodesh. Kodesh Kodashim, the Holy of Holies. Here, we learn more information. It has to be eaten b'makom kadosh, b'chatzar o hamoed yochlua. It's giving us similar information. It's really the same. Fundamentally, it's the same. The Kohanim get to eat whatever leftover there is of the Korban Mincha. But the point that Rabbi Grossman is pointing out, that I'm trying to point out as well, is that you have more detail as to what the Kohen does. It's not just Kohen eats it, okay, let's move on. The Kohen eats it. This is where he has to eat it, in this location. There's more. That's what's additional about the Korban Mincha and Parshat Tzav, is that it's giving us more, not just that he eats it, but more details about how the Kohen eats it. And the same comes up if we look at in the Korban Chatat, in source number 5. Similarly, so we have here the Korban Chatat, comparing how the Chatat is presented in Parshat Vayikra versus Parshat Tzav. V'dibar Hashem el Moshe l'emor, Hashem spoke to Moshe saying, "Speak to the children of Israel saying, if anyone sins unintentionally in all the things which Hashem has commanded not to be done and does any one of them, if the anointed priest sins..." Okay, so we saw earlier that the anointed priest was that first one. Verses 3 through 12. Okay, so now it's going to go through all the details when the anointed priest is the one who offers the korban. He shall bring the bull to the door of the tent of meeting before Hashem. He shall lay his hand on the head of the bull and kill the bull before Hashem. The anointed priest shall take some of the blood of the bull, bring it to the tent of meeting. The priest shall dip his finger in the blood, sprinkle some of the blood 7 times before Hashem, before the veil of the sanctuary, and he shall pour out all the rest of the blood of the bull at the base of the altar of the burnt offering. No, yeah. Did I just skip a line? No, the base of the altar of the burnt offering, which is at the door of the tent of meeting, and it goes on, the bull's skin, all its flesh, and its head, and its legs, and innards, and dung, even the whole bull shall be carried forth outside of the camp to a clean place, where the ash shall be poured out, and burn it on wood, put it on wood with fire, where the ashes are poured out, it shall be burned. Okay, so it's giving us the details, the Korban Chatat, you know, burnt up the slaughter, it gives the details specifically for the Kohen here. Continuing here, though, in Parshat Tzav, we're talking about the Korban Chatat. V'dibar Hashem el Moshe. Sorry, okay. V'dibar Hashem el Moshe le'mor. Hashem spoke to Moshe, saying, "Speak to Aaron and his son, saying, this is the law of the sin offering. In the place where the burnt offering is killed, the sin offering shall be killed before Hashem." It's linking right now the burnt offering, linking the Korban Olah and the Korban Chatat, the Ola offering and the Chatat offering are linked together here. Lifnei Hashem Kodesh Kodeshim. Hakohen HaMachateota Yochlena. And now it goes on, talking, the priest who offers it shall eat it. It shall be eaten in the holy place, in the court of the tent of meeting. Whatever shall touch its flesh shall be holy. When there is any of its blood sprinkled on the garment, you shall wash that on which it was sprinkled in a holy place. But the earthen vessel in which it was boiled shall be broken. If it's boiled in a bronze vessel, it may be scoured and rinsed in water. Every male among the priests shall eat of it. It is most holy. No sin offering of which any of the blood is brought into the tent of meeting to make atonement in the holy place shall be eaten and shall be burned with the fire. But the point here, and there's a highlighting, you have a whole chunk, this idea of the who eats the korban and the rules about where it's eaten and how it's eaten and if it, the blood comes on this, it comes on that, who has to eat it, every male priest shall eat of it. None of that information do we have in the korban chatat described in Vayikra. Vayikra gives us a very straight, here's what the Kohen's going to do. He's going to do this, he's going to do this, he's going to flay the animal, he's going to burn it here, he's going to do this, pour the ashes over here, that. In Parshat Tzav, it doesn't even give us any of those details. It spends much more of its time talking about who gets to eat it. The Kohen who does it, he gets to eat it, has to be in this location and like this. If it touches this, it becomes like this. You have to sprinkle this if it goes in there. All these details about the Kohen and the experience of consuming the Korban. That seems to be the focus of the Korban Chatat in Parshat Tzav. And then more, continuing to the other parts that we've seen, the Korban Asham and the Korban, where are we here? The Korban, so we saw the Ola, Mincha, Chatat, and so now looking at the Asham and the Shlamim. So here's the way, again, the way it's presented in Parshat Tzav. Next week's Parsha, Kol Zachar HaKohanim Yochlenu B'Makom Kadosh Yachel. It's emphasizing who gets to eat it. The Kohanim, they eat it in a Makom Kadosh. Kachatat Ka'asham, and the Chatat is linked to the Asham. Torah Chad Lahem HaKohen Asher Yechaper Lo Yehiyah. It's talking about who gets to eat it, whose is it. And then when it comes to the Shlamim, Zotarat Zevach HaShlamim, this is the rules of the Shlamim, Asher Yekriv LaHashem, peace offers which one shall offer to Hashem. If he offers it for thanksgiving, then he shall offer with the sacrifice of thanksgiving, unleavened cakes mixed with oil, unleavened wafers anointed with oils, cakes, okay, cakes of leavened bread, he shall offer his offering with the sacrifice of his peace offering for thanksgiving. Of it shall he offer with one out of each offering for the heave offering to Hashem. It shall be the priest who sprinkles the blood of the peace offerings. The flesh of the sacrifice of the peace offerings shall be for Thanksgiving shall be eaten on the day of his offering by its owner. You should not leave any of it until morning. The idea here again is that the Shlamim in Parshat Tzav is focusing on the consumption. Who's eating it? Who gets to eat it? What Rabbi Grossman points out is that in all of these, what we've seen in when it comes to the Ola and the Mincha offering, there's focus on who's eating it. The leftovers, okay, Parashat Vayikra says, okay, there are leftovers eaten by the Kohen. But inside, the leftovers are eaten by a Kohen in a specific location because it's Kadosh, Chatzar Ol Moed. When it's the Chatat, it goes all this information about the blood, who gets to eat it, if there any blood sprinkles on a garment. There's so much, it's all focusing on the experience of the Kohen eating the Mincha. And also, if I may just go out of order, step back. We also saw in Parshat Tzav, and it was talking about the Ola offering, where in Vayikra, the Ola offering, which is, okay, you burn it, done. In Tzav, when it talks about the Ola, it goes on about the order of the process of the Kohen when he brings the Ola offering, and then he takes the ashes. There's all this information about wearing his uniform, scooping up the ashes, moving them here, outside of the camp. There's so much more information given about what the Kohen is doing in the Parshat Tzav than there is in Parshat Vayikra. So, maybe that was a little quick, but bottom line is that we see the distinction, what's happening between Parshat Vayikra and Parshat Tzav. Rabbi Grossman is pointing out is that in Parshat Vayikra, that's where you have the basic information. Here's the Korban. Here's how it's given. Done. In Parshat Tzav, there's a much more of a focus, not only on the Korban, but also on the consumption of the Korban and on the goings on of the Kohanim. It's not just about the Kohen offers it, but as the Kohen offers it, he gets to eat the leftovers and he has to eat them in a specific location. Whatever the Kohen's going to eat, he has to eat it in a certain way. If any of the blood sprinkles on anything, if he touches anything, it touches anything. These are the rules of it. It's focusing on the consumption of the Korban, which you did not find in Parshat Vayikra. And based on that, and this is source number 7, this is from his article called Kohanim in Israel, source number 7, if the new emphasis appearing in Tzav concerns the eating of the sacrifices, then it is clear why the peace offerings appear at the end of the list. First, we read about the Ola, which is completely burnt upon the altar. Thereafter comes those sacrifices of which the Kohanim eat part, the Mincha, sin offering, the guilt offering. And finally, the exceptional sacrifice of which the owners also eat, the peace offering appears. In other words, what he's saying is, if we go back to the summary, the comparison of the three, of the two, Parshat Vayikra is focused on the person, you know, the experience of giving the Korban. So you start with the Ola and the Mincha. Those are both voluntary. Then you go, and Shlamim. That's also voluntary. And then you have Chatat and the Asham. Those are obligatory. But what he's saying is that the Tzav is not really focused on the person, me, bringing the Korban. Why am I bringing the Korban? Am I bringing the offering because I'm choosing to? Or am I bringing the offering because I'm obligated to? That's how it's broken up in Vayikra. Voluntary, obligatory. But in Tzav, he says, it's not like that. Tzav, it's going in a progression from about who gets to eat it. Is it just completely consumed? Is it partially eaten by people? Is it, it's only, sorry, is it fully consumed by the fire? Only the Kohen eats it, or the Kohen eats it with the person who brought it. And it's a progression in that way. And that's why Shlamim comes at the very end, because the Shlamim is one that's shared between the Kohen and the person bringing it. Whereas, you know, the Korban Chatat isn't, it's just the Kohen, and the Ola is just Hashem. It's just the fire. So it's progressing. It's not progressing by voluntary or obligatory. But Grossman points out, Tzav is progressing differently. It's focused on the Kohen experience. What does the Kohen get to eat? Nothing? All of it? Some of it? That's how Parsha Tzav is laid out. That's how he presents that. And he continues in source number 8. In this light, the reason for the differing structure of the two parshiot is clear. In our parsha, Parsha Vayikra, where the Israel is the focus, the categories are clearly voluntary and obligatory sacrifices. From the point of view of a person bringing the sacrifice, these are two completely different experiences, and his whole visit to God's house changes in light of the reason that he's bringing the sacrifice. Or am I going because I'm choosing to, I want to bring a Korban Todah and grateful for something to Hashem? Or am I doing it because I sinned majorly and I have to bring a Korban to make it up? Those are totally different experiences. This difference, though, is almost completely irrelevant to the Kohen who serves in the Beit HaMikdash. It even mentions that, okay, the location, the Korban Ola, which is a voluntary Korban, and the Korban Chatat, which is because of a sin, those are in the same location. And even the Parshat Tzav even says, oh, it's in the same place. Right? As far as the Kohen's concerned, it's all the same. The Ola Chatat, it's going to be the same. The difference, though, so he says, the difference, though, is almost completely irrelevant to the Kohen who serves in the Beit HaMikdash. The sacrificial ritual is not directly influenced by the reason for the sacrifice being brought. Whether the sacrifice is voluntary Ola or obligatory one, the Kohen's work still involves stripping the animal's skin, cutting it into parts, burning parts of it, etc. From the point of view of the Kohen on duty, the more important question is who eats the sacrifice. In other words, it is important to him, both practically and experientially, whether the sacrifice in question is an Ola, of which he cannot partake at all, or one in which he has a portion, or a peace offering, which, as the name indicates, brings and symbolizes peace, and all of those involved eat of its meat. And he's saying that essentially what we're talking about is who's the focus? Is the focus is the person who's bringing the korban? So what I'm going to tell, when Hashem's going to tell us, when the Torah's going to tell us what are the details of the korban, it's going to present certain information, it's going to leave out other information, it's going to focus on what it is that I need to know as the person who's bringing the korban. But for Tzav, you and I don't know if there are any Kohanim here, but I am not a Kohen. I'm not the focus. The focus really is on the Kohen, the Kohen's experience. What is he going to eat? What's it going to be? And so for that, he said, that's why there's so much more information about the who's eating, because that's the audiences. That also would explain why there's so much more information about the scooping up of the ash here and there and all these other things. So that's specifically related to the avoda, the work that the Kohen's going to do. And it also explains why, going back here, why the Kohen's specific mincha all of a sudden shows up in Parashat Tzav. We have no mention of it in Parashat Vayikra, because it doesn't really matter. The Parashat Vayikra is not for the Kohen. Parashat Vayikra is for the average Joe Shmo Ben Yisrael, or Bat Yisrael, me. So that's why I don't need to have that. In Tzav, which is focusing specifically on the Kohen's experience, the Kohen slaughtering the animal, burning the animal, doing all the work with the animal, so that's going to have to be that. That makes the absolute sense. When you're talking about the mincha, oh, we're talking about mincha. Let's also mention the Kohen specific korban mincha, because we're talking about Kohanim anyway. It would have been lost and irrelevant to tell the Kohen specific mincha in Parshat Vayikra, because Parshat Vayikra's audience is not the Kohen. Parshat Vayikra's audience is you and me. So Kohen specific mention is mentioned in the mincha in Parshat Tzav. This idea is also the Ramban al HaTorah. The Ramban in his commentary to the Torah also observes this idea. Basically, already from the very beginning of the words of Parshat Tzav. So he points out the Ramban is bothered by the fact that there's so much repetition between Parshat Vayikra and Parshat Tzav, between this upcoming week's Parsha and the Parsha afterwards. Amara Katuv, the Parsha Vayikra, is saying, Davero B'nei Israel. He says, look, pay attention to what it says. Parshat Vayikra opens up Pasuk Bet, Daber al Bnei Yisrael. Speak to the children of Israel. Hisham Yitzveh Havaad Behavaad Korbanot. There, Eve Yisrael Mevinotam. There in Parshat Vayikra, the audience, the Torah starts out by saying, Vayikra al Moshe v'Daber Shem Elav V'Yom Lemor, Daber al Bnei Yisrael. Go speak to Bnei Yisrael. The audience of Parshat Vayikra is Bnei Yisrael. And so it's going to be geared towards them. The Kan Amar here is commenting on Parshat Tzav. Tzav et Aaron. Parshat Tzav opens up. Command to Aaron. Kedaber b'maaseh ha-korbanot. V'kohanim yasu otam. He says, look, Parshat Vayikra is about bringing korbanot. That goes to all of Bnei Yisrael. Because they're all going to bring korbanot. Parshat Tzav, it's not to Bnei Yisrael. It's to the Kohanim. Kohanim are the ones who are going to do the maaseh of the korban. And so there's two. You have one version that's said to the whole people. One version that's said to the just the Kohanim. Okay. And there's why, that's why they're two different presentations. They're listed in two different ways. Someone here is pointing out, Talmidei Chachamim Marvim Shalom, because he sacrificed, the sacrifices are shared by lay people who bring them. Yeah. They're mentioned. Last sacrifice, you say, Acharon, Acharon, Chaviv. The best sacrifice of all is the one that everyone shares together. Thank you very much, Gershon, for putting that out there in the chat box. There you go. Beautiful. Yeah. Tamarich Chachamim Rabbi Shalom. It's a good, sorry.
Thank you. It's a wonderful shiur.
Well, we still got a little bit more to talk about. Don't worry. Just a little bit more. I want to draw attention to what Rav Shimshon Fala Hirsch says also at the very beginning of Parshat Tzav, which I think will lead to, and this will be the, we can have a chaplaincy tie-in for Rabbi Kelman as well, that Rav Shimshon Fala Hirsch says the following. He also is noting the comparison here. He says, the preceding Parsha, chapters 1 through 5, describes the various kinds of offerings, korbanot nedava, free will offerings, namely Ola, Mincha, and Shlamim, and the korbanot chova, obligatory offerings that atone for sin, like the Chatat and Yasham, and explains various halachos of the offerings. Knowledge of these halachos is the, vital also to the Be'alim, who seek to draw closer to God through these offerings. The halachos explained in the next two chapters complement those of the preceding chapters, but concern primarily the Kohanim, who are charged with offering the korbanot. Hence, these halachos are addressed specifically to Aaron Ubanav. Accordingly, the order of them, the offerings has changed. He has a different reason, not like Rabbi Grossman, who thought it had to do with, Rabbi Dr. Grossman had to do with who gets to eat it, but he's saying it has to do with the sanctity, not arranged according to motive for bringing them, nedava versus chova, voluntary versus obligatory, but according to the degree of their sanctity, kodshe kodashim, kodshim kalim. Thus, the ola, mincha, and chatat, and asham are treated first, followed by the shlamim, kodshe kodshim kalim. That's how Rav Hirsch explains it. But I think what really struck me about this line for Rav Hirsch, which I think is very important to this, and this is something that Rabbi Grossman writes about as well, is this line here, that even though the average Joe Schmo, Ben Yisrael, Bat Yisrael, they're not going to be in the Mishkan, in the Beit HaMikdash, engaged in the sprinkling of the blood here and this and that, these halachot are still vital to the Baalim who seek to draw closer to God through these offerings. Ultimately, Hashem's saying, Hashem could just say, you know what, Jared, when you want to bring a korban, you know, korban ola, just show up to the Beit HaMikdash with an animal, and the Kohen will take it from there. And I won't learn about Sefer Vayikra. I won't learn Parshat Vayikra. I won't learn Parshat Tzav even. Because we'll say, look, Jared, you don't have to worry. Don't worry. Don't worry about it. Just show up with the animal. Tell the Kohen what you're there for. I'm there for this. He'll take it. You don't have to worry about it. But Rav Hirsch is pointing out, and I think this is important for why we have Parshat Vayikra, is that that's not the way the process works. It's not simply that I just show up to the Beit HaMikdash with my animal. I say, Cohen, you know, I sinned. I did a korban chat. I violated Shabbat unintentionally. I didn't realize it was Shabbat, and I winnowed. I don't know. And I winnowed on Shabbat, not realizing it was Shabbat. Here's my korban chatat. Okay, he says, okay, check this box, do this, that. You know, it's not like, I don't know, it's end of, towards the end of March right now. It's not like filing taxes, right? Just, okay, I send my stuff to the accountant. He sends me back, okay, sign this, send a check here, and then you're done. No, what the Torah wants and expects, Rav Hirsch is saying, knowledge of this is vital to the Baalim. The Torah wants, the Shem wants me to know all the goings on. And so I'm going to get that my special sefer, or my special parsha, Parshat Vayikra, I don't need to get all the information about who eats what and when. That's going to be for the Kohanim. They'll get Parshat Saf, which I'm still going to read, but that's not, I'm not the intended audience for that. The intended audience, Jared, what you have is Parshat Vayikra. And it's important because you need to know what's going on. And that I think is a really powerful idea in general about Judaism, about the, what the Torah wants, is that it's a fairly democratic system in the sense that even though the Kohanim have different experiences than I have, the Kohanim are eligible for eating all sorts of different things, the Torah makes a point of letting me know what it is and how it goes. And even all the laws. But I get specifically Parshat Vayikra because it's geared towards me and I still get all the information packaged slightly differently. But it's important for me to know that. My connection now to chaplaincy work, that I spent a summer several years, I mean, this is now like 10 years ago, in Fort Jackson in South Carolina. It was me and 95 Protestant Christians and, you know, like four Catholic, like Protestant ministers and four Catholic priests. It was me. It was like 100 of us. I was the one Jew. And what I thought was interesting is they did this whole like video of like different religion, different religious leaders, like of their own. Like they did a video where they were dressed in their fatigues, right? In their combat uniform. And then they're sort of like this, a fade out where there was then a picture of them in their, what's the word? Like clerical uniform. You know, with the priest, with his thing there, and ever, and they were asking me like, what do rabbis wear? I was like, I can tell you what I wear. They're like, no, but what's the appropriate clothing for the rabbi? Is it like the prayer shawl? I was like, no, the prayer shawl is for prayer. Is it the thing, the boxes? Like, no, that's actually. They're like, do you have anything that you wear that makes you identifiable as a rabbi? I was like, not really. Like, I just the rabbi isn't. In a different zone. The rabbi learned, the thing that makes the rabbi a rabbi is the rabbi's learned, presume, hopefully, has learned a little more than the rest of the congregation. But there's not necessarily an apparent thing you can point to and say, ah, this is a different person. And they were sort of shocked by that. They were shocked at the idea that the rabbi, who's the religious leader, there wouldn't be anything significant about the rabbi's appearance or any way. And I thought, you know, that's my tie into this, that Judaism really doesn't have that. Judaism doesn't have this. We have more people who are more learned and less learned, and people who are qualified to lead a community in something are not qualified. But it's open to everyone. We, Judaism, we want everyone to learn. We want everyone to have exposure to these ideas. It's not that we're going to say, oh, you're not a Kohen. You don't really, you shouldn't learn Sefer Vayikra. You just skip to the Midbar. We'll give you some of the narrative portions of Vayikra, but you don't need to learn it because you're not a Kohen. You're not, it's not relevant for you. The Torah wants it there because I think what Rav Hirsch is saying is that there's a value for me to know. Even if I'm not going to be the one offering the korban, I'm not going to be the Kohen, there's still something important to me as a Jew knowing what's going on in the Beit HaMikdash, knowing what's going on in the Mishkan, knowing what the Kohanim are doing. Nothing there is private. There's nothing there that's a secret. You don't get to know because you're not a Kohen. I think that's a really important idea of Judaism in general, is that it's open to all of us, and we just have to take the choice and do the work to actually explore it and to learn it. It's laid out for us. Sefer Vayikra lays it all out for us. It might be easier for me to just say, it's confusing. I don't really understand this korbanot anyway. I'm not a Kohen. I'm never going to have to do it. There's no Beit HaMikdash nowadays. Forget it. But that's not the intention. I think that's what Rav Hirsch thinks is the goal here. The goal is for us to... The goal is for us to engage and to learn. And not say, it's not for me, it's not for you. But no, this is Torah. It's for all of us. We should all explore it and learn it. And I think that's probably the most important thing. So who is safe Parshat Vayikra for? It's for us. Even us non-Kohanim who have no concept of what it is. And we're not going to end up doing any of the blood sprinkling and any of that. But it's important for us to know it. Especially for us. The Kohanim, they're going to learn Parshat Vayikra. They're going to learn all the different, sorry, they're going to learn Parshat Tzav. All the different details that they need to know as the Kohen. But for me, as a non-Kohen, it's still important for me to know. It's necessary for me to know. It's in the Torah, and we should be able to learn it. And even if it's not practical right now or at all, because I'm not a Kohen, there's still something important to understanding the mechanism by how it is that we worship Hashem, whether we're Kohanim or whether we're Levim or whether we're regular Yisraelim. I think that's the idea of Parshat Vayikra, and I think of Sefer Vayikra in general. And we should be able to engage in learning and deepen that relationship. And as Rav Hirsch had said, ultimately, draw closer to God through the offerings and through the learning of Torah.
It's interesting. It's interesting, isn't it, that Rabbi Hirsch wore clericals. In other words, he wanted to be seen as a rabbi, contrary to the paradigm that you told your friends in South Carolina.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I wonder. I don't know. I'm by far no expert in Rav Shimshon Flora Hirsch. But I wonder, you know, to what degree was that, you know,
but to weren't, what degree... weren't the cler- wasn't the clerical garb based on the non-Jewish clerics? In other words, it was borrowed because that's what the Protestant ministers wore. It wasn't a uniquely Jewish thing. That was taken from society in general.
And that's why Frum rabbis didn't approve of Hirsch's decision.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say, I wonder to what degree Rav Hirsch was motivated by the reality around him. And yeah, so.
I mean, it was, if I may, it was part of being, you know, a modern rabbi. And that was one of the 10 things, you know, the rabbis in Mechelov in Hungary banned about shul. You know, you can't have a shul where the rabbi speaks in the vernacular. So the rabbi wore clerical robes or had a choir, but they had a choir, of course. They still do embroiderers. That was things that put you outside of the pale, according to some people. But I guess what's interesting is the clerical robes was a big fight, correct? The German rabbis wore them, but the Shmaimel and the Bekeshe, which also is borrowed from the non-Jews, somehow became not the machloket. So I don't know. I don't know anybody ever saying that's chukat goyim to wear the Hasidisha clothes, which was borrowed from the Polish nobility. If anybody has any comments on that, I'd be happy
I
to
will say, I just, I don't have an answer to that.
The Shmaimel was not just for the rabbi. The Shmaimel was for every Yid.
Right.
Well, on that point, I'll tell you what my Zadie Alav HaShalom, born in Malawa, Poland, in the early 20s, said when he was growing up, the rabbi was the one who had the shtreimel. So nowadays, every Tom, Dick, and Harry, where anyone wants to wear a shtreimel, wears to wear a shtreimel. He thought it was very, he was like, that's not how it was when I was growing up. So maybe only a few people could afford one. But
that's true about a lot of things that only the rabbi. I mean, and we've mentioned in other classes, you know, Shifrel Hirsch, he was the only one allowed to wear his talus over the head. Balabatim were not allowed to put their talus over their head. Or yet other customs that only the rabbi could do. Because, you know, he's different. Bala, it's Wiskins. You are as Chaim Soloveitchik notes, you are as gone out of style. Your religious arrogance to show off your religious practice. So that today, that's very much in vogue. But that we do it. But it's prohibited to do it. That's but nobody follows that prohibition anymore. It's sort of like wearing your tzitzis out. That was also a thing. Only rabbis should wear their tzitzis out. But anyways, okay. All right, any other comments, questions? Vakasha, as we begin the book of Korbanot, which, you know, actually takes up less of the book. Yes, Ben, you want to ask something?
Sure. I have a few questions.
I would not expect anything less.
Well, I don't know about the whole thing about smicha. Isn't there a controversy whether it was the person bringing the korban who did the smicha on the animal or whether it was the Kohen himself who did it? That would be one question, because I know there's this controversy about it. The other is...
who's allowed to do smicha? Yeah.
The other question is, in light of what you're saying about that this is something Amcha should know, I get frustrated, and I think others do too, when we know stuff, but you still have to ask the rabbi. Is the shaver okay? Is the air to breathe okay? Is the water okay? So, and we know we have sex within Judaism, that is their whole raison d'etre. So are you saying that Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch is against dynastic rabbis and that kind of relationship, which would be a nice statement to say and true, but it might be politically difficult to say that?
What I'll say is that I wrote in our Toronto Torah as a publication. It might actually be somewhere in this room. I mean, I happen to be zooming in from Shari Shemayim. I should thank Shari Shemayim for letting me use the Beit Midrash here. I wrote a piece in our Toronto Torah a little while. I was either last week or 2 weeks ago. I don't remember right now. but it was a piece quoting, I quoted Rav Schechter quoting Rav Soloveitchik. No, I think it was Rav Schechter quoting Rabbi Lamb quoting Rav Soloveitchik. There were like, it was like klish lishi. It was a couple of different steps. But said that he thinks the whole concept of Das Torah, or you just ask Das Torah, ask the rabbi will tell you, and then you do it. Rav Soloveitchik was very opposed to that concept. That's not the way we do it. You want to talk an idea. You want to have him give a suggestion. And okay, but the idea of saying, oh, that's what the rabbi said, and that's it. Rav Schechter quotes Rabbi Lam. I think it was Rabbi Schechter quoting Rabbi Lam, quoting Rav Soloveitchik, was opposed to
very
it.
Very Talmudic. So,
that doesn't really answer your question necessarily, but I think it's tangentially related enough that I sound like I know what I'm talking about.
All right. And then in terms of, you said one, I like that, by the way, very the focus on the what the priests care about, what am I going to eat, basically, and what the people are doing. So in light of the Mishnah describing what went on in, I forget if it was in Rosh Hashanah or something, where, you know, when they do the eeny, meeny, miny, mo for which priest is going to look after which person, and people cheated and threw and pushed each other, and they were broken feet and all that. So was God effective enough in showing the people what was going on, or did still, because people are venal and greedy and small-minded, whether you're born into a priestly family, like, yeah, so I know, but I'm not there saying, priest, put that thumb down.
I'm not sure. What should I say? I don't know what to say. I don't know. What can I say? Maybe, humans aren't always so great.
Maybe the central place of sacrifice was a mistake, because we know that certainly before that, the Bamot, certainly by the shot of the Tanakh, were not disallowed. People were allowed to do all that stuff till a certain point. You want to reread into it that it wasn't allowed. That's rereading it. That's not pshat. So maybe the central focus was incorrect.
Okay. Okay. That'll be part two.
I like the correct. It didn't work. There's a difference between it being correct. No, I mean, on a certain level, but yeah. I mean, obviously it failed, and that's why we lost the Beit HaMikdash, if you want to really go down to that. The Jewish people weren't worthy. So that's why we lost it. You're right. But the idea of centrality, I think, is very important. They didn't want everybody doing their own thing. They wanted a sort of a, we can only worship God through sacrifices in one place, at least once we built the Beit HaMikdash. Yeah, of course, originally the Bamot were allowed.
But Rabbi, with respect, you had two things going on almost simultaneously with centrality. The kingship, which should have been a centralizing force, and the central temple. And because the Ohel Moed got to move around, you know, like we want in Canada the Supreme Court to move around occasionally. So we didn't, did God or the Nevi'im allow enough time for the first of those institutions to really take root, you know? You ended up with, when there was a mashbir with the malchut, there was a mashbir at exactly the same time with the central sacrificial place. We didn't, it wasn't enough time for either one to take root and be strengthened.
Okay. That's listen. We know that
what to think about.
they were upset. Shlomo Melech. Well, I mean, they were upset when they asked for a king. Shmuel said, "What do you need a king for?" You know, that's a whole other part of Machloket. But okay, we'll leave that for another time. But I agree. Yes, correct. The kingship is a big problem. But the Shoftim didn't work any better. That was probably worse. Isha Yashar Bein Avyasa. So life is complicated. It's up
but
to people.
But there wasn't a breakaway kingdom through all that. It didn't work necessarily as well as it could have, but they were still a loose federation at that point still.
Rabbi, you have anything else to say? Otherwise, we'll let you. It's a little late. People eat dessert, you know, start a little late this week. But thank you, Rabbi.
I'll just know to leave. Okay. I'll just try to avoid
that. Well, I was wondering what your background is. Now I recognize the background in Sher Shvayim. I wasn't sure. Okay. Now I know where you are. But okay, very good. Okay. Tomorrow
thank
morning.
You, everyone.
Thank you, Rabbi. Shabbat Shalom at Purim Sameach. Of course, this Sunday we won't be having our regular classes because of the Purim, but I will be giving my regular class on the Shir tomorrow morning, 9:15. Everybody invited. We're going to do Surya Srogdo Alo, and then we're going to start probably next week, Mamish, on the Amida after class 122. So, slowly, slowly working our way through the Seder. Everybody's invited 9:15. And then we'll continue Monday night, Dr. Shapiro, Mark Shapiro, on the Mussar dispute. So he has spoken a lot about Shimon Raphael Hirsch and other, you know, and that whole era, you know, 19th century orthodoxy, lots to discuss there. But okay. Listen, everybody, Laila Tov, Shabbat Shalom. We should hear good things. And, the Chodesh should be, we should have a nice Purim Bizman Hazeh because we need it, at least as much as they needed it in Shushan. So, let's hope so. Okay. Laila Tov, everybody. Right. Shabbat Shalom.
Take care.
Be well.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Rabbi. Okay. Be well. Bye bye.
Thank you so much.